But for tonight, we have the great treat of listening to Professor Robert Gilbert. He's going to be speaking to us tonight on the very fascinating and somewhat contradictory, often it's felt, topic of beauty and science and how the two actually cohere. Professor Gilbert is the professor of biophysics here at Oxford, and he has been a tutor at Magdalen College since 2012. He's now based in the Department of Medicine, in the Nuffield Department of Medicine, where he's also the director of graduate studies. He's also a priest. He was ordained in 2011 and has served in parishes in and around Oxford, most recently becoming the associate priest at Holy Trinity Church in Headington. So please join me tonight in welcoming Professor Robert Gilbert.
Thank you, Jenny, very much. And what I'm going to speak to you about tonight, this sort of topic of science and beauty, why you have to be human to work things out, that sort of gives you a gist, the subtitle gives you a gist of where I wanted to go, that I wanted to explore why it is that human beings are uniquely capable, as far as we know, of coming to understand the world in a scientific way. And I will touch towards the end on why that might have some theological implications, and specifically some implications which are of interest to Christians. I should say it's an area which, in one sense, I've been working on for a few years, actively. It's actually, in another sense, that I've been working on, I feel, for more than 20 years, because looking back, it's the way in which my science has developed, my scientific interests have developed over the years, has always had in tandem these two aspects of what I do. So the enjoyment of the beauty of what I study, the beauty of what I find in the world, and the scientific facts that I discover through that enjoyment. And indeed, looking back, the reason why I read biochemistry when I first went to university in 1992 was because of the way in which I thought molecular structures were beautiful. And I suspect any of you who are scientists may have similar kinds of stories, as indeed those of you who are theologians or social scientists or whatever may well have stories about how what you find beautiful in your areas of study is what led you to study them in the first place. I apologise if any of you have heard me talk on this before, but since I've been on a journey, as it were, over the last 20 or more years, and more intensely over the last few years as I've been working on this as a specific topic, hopefully I'll have moved on and have something interesting and new to say if you have heard me on this topic before. What I wanted to do, first of all, is actually to get you very briefly, because we don't want to mess up the recording too much, get you very briefly to just chat to your neighbour about what does beauty mean to you? And in that question, I had sort of two things in mind, because you can sort of put your emphases in different places. What does beauty mean to you? So, you know, why do you value beauty? But also, what does beauty mean to you? So, i.e., what is it that you find beautiful? What are the kinds of things you think are beautiful? Why do things matter to you in such a way that you think they're beautiful? So it's a sort of, you can put the emphasis in two different places, I say. What, you know, what does it mean to you to find something beautiful? Why are you glad when you find something beautiful? And then coupled to that, what does beauty mean to you? What is it that you find beautiful? So we'll just spend, you know, a minute or two on that, and then it'd be very helpful to get a little bit of feedback, and then it'll lead, I think, quite helpfully into what I want to say following on from that. So.
I have a lot of people who are this is brilliant, and you don't, you mentioned worrying about the recording, but this sort of conversation, feel free to indulge in absolutely as much of it as you want.
Sorry, no, I was only doing this once, but it's helpful to get people engaged.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and we, it exists for
the time.
No, 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 but you mentioned worrying about the recording, and I just want to say, don't worry about
it. That's fine. So, you sound like you're enjoying it about beauty, and of course you would be, because that's one of the things about beauty, we enjoy it. But, sorry, I'm very rude. But, do you have any sort of feedback for me as to, first of all, you know, we don't have to take it in turns, but, you know, what does beauty mean to you? What do you feel about beauty? How do you react to it? But also, what does beauty mean to you? What kinds of things do you find beautiful? And I think this hopefully might be helpful to move on to think about science and beauty. So any comments at all?
In our group, we were talking about how hard it is to distinguish between objective and subjective beauty.
Right.
And how hard it is to make claims about beauty because of this chasm that we seem to feel between objective and subjective ways of defining what beauty is.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And I guess that's actually quite close again to what I want to explore, because clearly beauty is fundamentally something which is subjective. I mean, as the old adage goes, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. But at the same time, there are things that many people agree on as being beautiful. But then oddly, some people disagree. I've got a friend who loathes the music of Mozart, and I think it's quite beautiful, you know. He also loathes Rioja, and I think Rioja is quite beautiful too, in its own way. They're very differently beautiful. But on the other hand, it's not that I don't like him as a friend. I do like him as a friend. It's just that he has this point of view. So we have different points of view about beauty. I guess one of the things that's good is that we all agree some things are beautiful. And I guess there are some common features that things we find beautiful have, even though they're different from each other. And so it's this meeting of the subject and the objective. And actually that's partly what I want to explore, in fact, the way in which what we find subjectively beautiful seems to be a route, maybe one of the best routes, to finding out what is objectively true, even though, and it really doesn't matter for this argument, even though what we think is beautiful won't be the same as each other, because we disagree, because just as the kind of people we are, the backgrounds we have, the cultures we come from, different cultures find different things very beautiful, whether it's a pattern on animal skin, a crack in a teacup, or flower arrangement, or whatever. People find things very, very beautiful, but for different reasons. And so, thank you. That's a very interesting point. Any other reflections on beauty, or what you find beautiful, or what you feel about it, what it means to you? Yeah.
I immediately thought of things that kind of transcend my everyday life. Uh-huh. So if I'm, you know, driving along on a normal street, and then all of a sudden, whoa, there's this huge panorama of a mountain or the ocean.
Yes.
Or suddenly you hear some beautiful melody.
Yes.
And it kind of draws you out of your normal context. That kind of, it's like that transcendent quality.
Yes, something transcendent. It draws you out of your normal context. And it's quite interesting the two examples you've used, because the melody is an example of something quite exquisite, something, and often, I notice this myself, if you hear even if it's a piece of music you know quite well, if you hear a snatch of it, it actually sounds somehow more beautiful. It pierces you more directly. You know, you hear a little bit of a Beethoven symphony and you think, gosh, that's amazing. And you've heard the whole thing before, maybe many times, but you react to it differently because it kind of pierces you, the exquisite beauty of that little bit of melody or the harmony that is surrounding it. Really pierces you. But then, on the other hand, you've got the kind of the gargantuan, the sort of the vast, the awe-inspiring. And I guess those are two different aspects of beauty that you need to put side by side, don't you? The exquisite, the traditionally beautiful, and the stuff which is actually sublime, stuff which really overwhelms us, mountainscapes and vast oceans and trackless wastes and things. And they are different. I may not say much more about this, but I think what science has to say about that is that, in a way, how science relates to the awesome is that it helps to see the beauty in the awesome by kind of cutting it down to size. Sounds bad because it sounds like we're trying to belittle it. That's not what I mean. What I mean is it helps us to see the exquisiteness with which the awesome is constructed. You know, the awesome is still made up of small things, little antelopes and little bits of rock and so on. You know, there's small things that additively make up what we find sublime, or small amount that, you know, that's just the individual waves in the sea contribute to the vast ocean that overwhelms us. And to understand the structure that gives rise to the vastness that is, we think, sublime, I think is one of the things that science does for us. But science does it by focusing on the exquisite, I think, but we'll explore that a bit more, on the things that individual scientists find beautiful on a small scale. Any other thoughts about beauty? About, yeah?
We were saying it's kind of, it gives joy.
Yes, it gives joy. So it gives joy, and it brings you out of yourself. Whether it's vast things or exquisite things, it brings you out of yourself. And it's more something that takes you beyond the everyday. It gives you joy. It makes you forget yourself, actually. And that's another part of what I want to say, that beauty is a way in which we kind of leave behind our egos, actually. We leave behind our self-consciousness, and we kind of engage just more directly with what is, with the way the world is. And I think that's fundamental to our appreciation of beauty in the everyday sense, whether it's a picture or a piece of music or another person, but also fundamental to the way in which scientists use beauty, because it's a process of engagement with what is there for itself. And that's something I very much want to explore, the way in which it's an expression of our joy when we find something beautiful, and the way in which it takes us out of ourselves, and in which we kind of almost give ourselves to what we study. We're more interested in it than we are in ourselves. And that is a very profound experience associated with seeing things that are beautiful, I think. Any other thoughts? So one thing that one can also, a general conclusion we can make from that, is that obviously beauty is, as we said, in the eye of the beholder. Beauty is very personal. Okay? It's very much to do with people, individual people, the individual people you are and I am. And that is significant because it shows us that just because something is beautiful doesn't necessarily, to me, doesn't necessarily mean it's beautiful to you, and nor does it necessarily mean that because I think something beautiful, say a particular theory is beautiful, or a particular equation, or a particular way of understanding a scientific process is beautiful, doesn't necessarily make it true because my data might be wrong or I might be misguided. But what is interesting, I think, is that we have to be people to understand things that are beautiful. Animals appreciate the world, they enjoy the world. My parents have a dog, I spend quite a lot of time with this dog when I visit. He likes playing with his ball, he enjoys the world, he loves swimming in the water. There are all sorts of ways in which animals enjoy the world, but they don't enjoy it in quite the way we do, because they don't enjoy it in a sense for itself. They don't say, I'm glad this is beautiful because it's not me. It's other than me. And that's another thing I want to explore, the way in which when we see beauty in the world, whether it's natural beauty, beauty of other people, beauty of music, beauty in science, what we're seeing is something which we recognise as not ourselves, but is valuable all the same. Or in fact, maybe is even more valuable possibly than ourselves, because we see it as being beautiful and not ourselves. It's different from ourselves. And that is very important to how we appreciate beauty and its independence from us, and how we experience joy in relation to it. What I want to do now, having sort of agreed that different people find different things beautiful, but that is part of what it is to be a human being, and it's part of what people are, to appreciate beauty in our individual ways, I just want to look at a few examples of scientists and beauty, some specific examples. And on my slide here, I've just got two slides, and this describes some of the ways in which scientists find beauty in their data, and in which beauty is for them a category which allows them to discover new things about the world. On the left is the famous cartoon from the paper by Watson and Crick describing the structure of DNA. Many of you will have seen that cartoon before. And one of the very interesting things just to point out about that paper in Nature from the 1950s is that it's couched in almost entirely ideal terms. They're basically saying, given a relatively small amount of information they had to hand, what would be the ideal way to construct the molecule of heredity, this DNA molecule which has the characteristics that it does, a particular chemical ratios that they knew existed and other features that they knew pertained to the structure. How would it be neat to construct this? What would be ideal? And the model they came up with is famously the double helix, based on what they knew about the chemistry of the molecules involved. And of course, the power that it has is that it gives a framework for understanding how DNA works. How DNA works as a molecule of heredity. And if they'd been wrong, then we wouldn't be talking about this. But they were right in their structure, and as a result, of course, they made their names and it made their careers. But the point is that that this DNA paper, the DNA paper describing this molecular structure, this proposed model, is put in ideal terms. They're basically saying what would be ideal, what would be cool, what would be the best way to try and do this. If you read its very short paper, that is the way in which it's phrased. And so they were working very much in terms of thinking about, I think I would say, about aesthetic qualities, about what would be fitting, what would be beautiful in a way, as a way of understanding the molecule that confers heredity, that the molecule that passes on genetic information, and they were right. That's one particular example of how two people used thinking about what would be beautiful as a way of understanding the structure of a particular molecule, an important molecule. They carried on, actually, and they carried on thinking about viruses, and the second column I have there, where it says platonic solids. Those this is actually the same platonic solid in three different versions. Platonic solids, just to say, so many of you probably know exactly what these things are. They're particularly associated with ancient Greece, although in fact they've been known about and valued by a range of cultures. Platonic solids refer to the way in which you can arrange polygons of a single type in a closed shell. So basically triangles in this case, you've got 20 triangles, it forms what's known as an icosahedron, a 20-sided shape. There are only five ways to do this. Maybe that's surprising, but maybe it isn't. It is what one person writing on symmetry calls far from trivial, because it is an extremely, maybe unexpected thing. There are only five ways to do it, but there are only five ways to do it. This is one of them. There are two others involving triangles, the tetrahedron, four sides, and the octahedron, eight. One way involving a pentagon, the dodecahedron, and one way involving a square, the cube, or hexahedron. Those are the only ways in which you can organise a single kind of polygon in a closed shell of defined shape and size. Now, that, Watson and Crick thought, when they were thinking about what might be the structure of viruses, they thought, wouldn't it be cool, wouldn't it be ideal, if the structure of viruses was something like this, where you could take a single kind of building block and repeat it again and again, and that would give you the structure of a virus. And indeed, that is the case, for many viruses. And down below is a picture of blue tongue virus, a very large virus particle. This is about 100 million atomic mass units, this structure. And you can see the iris being cut away, so you can see the RNA inside, the double-stranded RNA, and then there's 120 copies of one protein forming the inner shell, and 720 copies of another protein forming the outer shell. This vast structure, resolved actually here in Oxford by some of my colleagues, that follows the same symmetry that Watson and Crick proposed for a virus based on ideal grounds, but it shows that definitely, this is the symmetry which many viruses possess. And many of you will perhaps also recognise the bottom molecule, that's a buckyball or Buckminster fullerene, a C60 molecule in this case, in which you have spherical carbon, something which is known to exist in stars as a result of the extreme conditions there, but which we can make on Earth, and which the identification which won Harry Crotter, among others, a Nobel Prize several years ago. And indeed, actually, it was this kind of image of spherical carbon that was one of the things that drew me into becoming a molecular scientist. But again, the reason I want to mention this is just this is again about the ideal. It's again about thinking about what would be cool, what would be a neat way to organise stuff to make the world work in the way we see it work. And in this case, platonic solids turned out to be a good way to do that for these cases, for the case of the virus, for the case of carbon 60, and it shows how what humans find aesthetically pleasing might be a good route into what we find to be true. But I want to go beyond that now, because and actually immediately the next thing I want to say does have some relationship to symmetry, but significant relationship to symmetry, but actually I want to go beyond it, because this is all very well, but many of you will have come across the idea that symmetry is a kind of beauty, and many of you will have come across the idea that mathematical equations express beauty, and we'll come back to that in a little bit, but basically symmetry and mathematical equations, they're errors that many people seem to be able to appreciate are beautiful for themselves. But I want to just think about a little bit more in terms of the ways in which humans use their thinking about beauty in their science. And the first example I want to give is shown here, where it shows the diagram of a hydrogen atom. I don't know, has anybody here read Frank Wilczek's book, A Beautiful Question? No. It is a good book, actually. So it was published, as you see, last year. He won the Nobel Prize for Physics in, I think, 2004 for his contribution to quantum chromodynamics. And this is a figure from his book. And what he's talking about, the overriding theme of his book, is this relationship between the ideal and the real, a relationship I sort of have already made some reference to in talking about DNA and platonic solids with respect to viruses and buckyballs, for example. But his constant theme in his book, A Beautiful Question, is about the relationship between the ideal and the real, and the way in which very simple relationships, which appear to humans to be aesthetically pleasing, turn out to be the way in which the world is structured, and structured at multiple levels. So he's actually a very musical man, as well as being a Nobel Prize winning physicist, and Wilczek puts alongside each other in this book three things: musical tones, which we find in harmony with one another as humans, the laws of electromagnetism developed by James Clerk Maxwell, expressed and developed, further developed by James Clerk Maxwell, and the work he himself has done on the quantum mechanical understanding of the structure of atoms, in this case of a hydrogen atom. And this is his picture for the different colours represent different phases of electrons within this hydrogen atom, to reflect his understanding of how what the internal structure of hydrogen atoms is. It's an attractive image in itself in some sense, but his key point is that some very simple relationships, which are about aesthetics, about what humans find pleasing, and actually in his case he would emphasise what humans find predictable, are the relationships which define not just musical tones that we find in harmony with one another, not just James Clerk Maxwell's laws, but also the rules governing the structure of a hydrogen atom. So he very strongly wants to emphasise the relationship between the real and the ideal. And for him, in his beautiful question, his answer is yes, the world is beautiful. In the world, the ideal and the real seem amazingly in harmony with one another. As another kind of example, again in the mathematical kind of area, but starting to think beyond it and think in terms of other areas of human endeavour, like music and how they might relate to science. And down below is another image that I've taken from the paper published by some of my colleagues, some geneticists, and I don't know whether any of you can notice any particularly interesting features. This is a project called the People of the British Isles Project, and you can see that different areas of the country are coloured in different colours. And the story behind this is that the group working on this wanted to look at how genetic populations varied around the country to understand the different genetic influences that had led to the modern day humans living in the British Isles. The rule they used was that they only wanted to look at genomes of people whose grandparents had been born close to one another. So they knew there were people who had strong roots in their particular parts of the country. And then what they looked for are patterns in the DNA which differed between people who were from different parts of the country and which were consonant with each other from people who were from the same part of the country. I don't know if you notice any surprising things about this. You can see there's a lot of red here in the middle. This is England. Does anybody notice anything strange about this? Has anybody seen this figure before?
No.
So I'll point out one or two interesting things about it. So one interesting thing is actually it used to be thought that there was something called a Celtic fringe. So there was a sort of genetic link as well as a cultural link that related people living in Cornwall and people living on the west coast of Scotland. And indeed, maybe people living in Cornwall, people living in Devon. One of the interesting things of this is, in fact, that it turns out that there is no such identifiable genetic commonality. In fact, the people in the west coast of Scotland, the people in Cornwall, are rather different from each other. And indeed, the people in Cornwall in pink here and the people in Devon in blue are very different from one another. So that analysis is interesting. Why has it got anything to do with beauty? It's got something to do with beauty because it's to do with classification. Because in order to carry out this study, what these researchers did, Peter Donnelly and his colleagues in Headington at the Wellcome Trust Centre, what they did was that they looked at the patterns that were similar between people who were living in the same area for long periods of time and compared them to patterns in the DNA which distinguished them from people living in other areas of the country, again for long periods of time. So looking at similarity, classifying people together on the basis of the genetic information led them to this very interesting population model. You might say, does it matter? Well, I think it matters basically as a demonstration of method, because you could use this, of course, to understand the susceptibility to disease throughout the world, and there are many diseases which have geographical variations in terms of their susceptibility, so this would be a useful set of technology to help you understand the genetic basis of conditions people suffer from in different parts of the world. But the fundamental take-home message from this for us, for our purpose this evening, is that they use classification for this. And classification is something that children do, human children do, from a very young age. It's some kind of hardwired almost, although I don't like the term hardwired, but anyway, it's some kind of innate property that humans have that they classify from a very young age, even pre-verbally. And indeed, those of you who maybe have children or have young people in your families will know that we encourage them to do this. That we give them blocks that are square and blocks that are triangular and blocks that are hexagonal, and we get them to put in the right kind of slots and so on. We encourage our children to think in terms of classification. I would say classification is fundamentally an aesthetic activity. It's putting things side by side and saying this is like that. It's actually part of our enjoyment of the world, part of our aesthetic enjoyment of the world, to look for similarity. And it's this kind of looking for similarity, it's a fundamental capacity that humans have, that has led my colleagues to work on looking at similarities of genetic information to understand the structure of the genetic inheritance of the people currently living in this country. Now, that relates to, before I get on to the issue of play, that relates to two other figures on this slide, one of which is very famous, one of which is less so, a crow with a stick, but both of which are related somehow actually to the people of the British Isles Project as well. And that's because the figure of Charles Darwin's phylogenetic tree here, and this clever crow down below, this New Caledonian crow from the Pacific with his stick, these two figures relate to the idea of analogy. And I already said that in some sense, I believe that the work on looking at genetic relatedness has a connection to looking for analogy between similar things, looking that is like this. Analogy further developed is actually to look at how we might model things that we find in the world in ways that are completely different from them but are faithful somehow to as expressions of what we find in the world. So here we have Charles Darwin trying to think about evolution and not being quite sure how to express his ideas, and so he famously writes "I think" and then draws this phylogenetic tree. And this is a basis for thinking about evolution that obviously has been hugely influential, it is a kind of exercise in analogy. He is using model making, a kind of diagram that he's drawing out. Children draw pictures of trees and dogs and their parents and things, which try and make sense of the world in the terms that they can. Darwin was trying to make sense of the world in the way that he could, given the data he had, and the way he tried to do it was by drawing this kind of a diagram where he says, "I think," and then draws out what he thinks the relationships might be in a phylogenetic tree. That is, I think, an exercise in phylogeny, and I think it's an aesthetic, it's a use of aesthetic appreciation of the world to draw up something which, personally, I think this is in itself, in some sense, aesthetically pleasing, but it's also an expression of something out there, of the nature of descent. And then down below, a final example of analogy is this clever crow. Now, this crow, and its crows are apparently terribly clever. When we say they're clever, I'm not sure they're clever like we're clever. I mean, they can't speak, but they can use twigs. When they use twigs, they can use them to get the food they want out of hollow sticks and things. And when we come to try and understand what the crow is doing, and this is actually from work that involved people in Oxford, Gavin Hamilton and colleagues in zoology, the clever crows, what they can do is that they seem to be able to take bits of natural world, twigs, and be able to refashion them to use them for their own purposes. But in order to understand that, we're using analogy again, because we don't really know what it's like to be a crow. We've no idea. With its strange reptile, or actually dinosaur brain, we've no idea what it means to be a crow. We've no idea what the world looks like to a crow, but we can understand what the crow is doing by analogy to what we ourselves do when we make tools. And I think there is, again, a sense in which we're using analogy there, and a sense, therefore, in which we're using aesthetics, saying, that looks a bit like what I might do if I was wanting to get something out of a narrow tube that I couldn't get with my own hands. So those are different ways in which scientists use thinking about the world as being, on one hand, ideal. What would be cool? What would be neat? What would be a really good way to find out how things are? And that turns out to be quite a good way to discover how things really are. But also how people can discover that some very simple ideas. So, for example, the simple ideas that relate in Wilczek's analysis, the notes which are harmonious with each other to a human perspective, turn out to be good ways to understand some fundamental aspects of how nature is in itself. And then how looking at classification of things into groups of similar populations or objects, whatever, or trying to analogize between the natural world and how we can represent it, are different ways in which we express our aesthetic enjoyment of the world. And I think those are ways in which science has a fundamental dependence on aesthetic appreciation by humans of the world in which we live. And there's one other example I want to give on the left here about playing games. Because scientists love to play games, and that is another aspect of enjoying the world aesthetically. We all love to play games in our various ways. And for me, a particular stimulus in thinking about this was this book, Homo Ludens, by Johann Huizinga. And his argument is that all life, all human culture is played. And it's a very attractive idea, it's a very interesting idea, and I think there's an element of truth in what he has to say. In terms of science, the example I want to give is actually, one particular example I want to give is the example of graphene, which many of you will have heard of, and which Andre Geim and his colleague Novoselov shared the Nobel Prize a few years ago. And the famous backstory to this is that they were wanting to work out how to isolate graphene, a single layer of carbon atoms, and they did it using 3M tape. And a graphite lead, and it was called what they called a Friday afternoon experiment, the kind of experiment that you do when you have a bit of spare time and you want to try out something that is almost certainly a waste of time or almost certainly won't work, I think would be worth doing. So they were trying to isolate graphene by pulling the surface off the graphite lead of their pencil, and they found that they could, and basically because they found out they were able to isolate graphene, that meant they could win the Nobel Prize for that work. You know, these are guys who were given to Friday afternoon games and given to doing things which other people might think were ridiculous. Another famous example from the same people is that they won an Ig Nobel Prize, a kind of sarcastic an example of a prize which is meant to sort of send up some of the research that scientists do that popular imagination might find ridiculous. They were trying to levitate a frog, and they succeeded, and they won this Ig Nobel Prize. Actually, really not very long before they won the genuine thing, the real Nobel Prize. It just goes to show that playfulness in science is actually very important, and playfulness is about enjoying the world. It is about aesthetic enjoyment of the nature of reality. And sometimes with games we need toys. Toys can help us play games with each other, and in science. So here's a picture of a very big toy near here, the diamond synchrotron, the diamond light source out at Harwell near Didcot. And that is an example of a very big toy. Scientists love their toys, and I'm afraid scientists are pretty bad with their toys sometimes. So, you know, children who have toys, if a child's got a toy, he wants the same toy, his friend wants the same toy as him. If somebody has one toy, the other person wants three. Certainly you find that in science. If somebody has a particularly fancy microscope, their friend will almost certainly want two or three of them. And if somebody has got a particularly powerful synchrotron, somebody else wants an even more powerful one, or bigger one, or better one. So there's a lot of competition, and it's all around game playing. And in the end, I don't think we should sort of pretend that scientists are somehow sort of they're not always being geniuses. They are, or even mildly clever. They are sometimes being pretty venal, and they are playing their games, and they are squabbling over their toys. They can behave very badly over it. But it's again all about enjoying the world. It's about the way in which, when scientists engage with the world, they are engaging with it aesthetically for the enjoyment they have. So what I've done is I've tried to give some examples of how beauty and science interrelate. I mean, actually, I didn't really say, but, you know, on this slide, of course, the kind of beauty that drew me in would be the kind of beauty that I see in that structure, the structure of a virus. I think it's amazing that we can see into the atomic details of such a structure and understand it for itself. But I think we can find beauty being used by scientists, aesthetic enjoyment of the world being used by scientists in all sorts of ways at all sorts of levels, from the purely mathematical to the extremely kind of applied, such as the crow and his stick, and indeed not only in terms of relatively high-minded things, but actually relatively low-minded things like squabbling over fancy toys and playing games, which can turn out to be more productive than many people thought. So the point is that aesthetic enjoyment is at the core of a lot of what scientists do. And I have two helpful quotes here. I hope they're helpful. And they reflect something of a summary of what I've tried to say before I try and put it in context. So the first helpful quote, I hope, is from a Catholic philosopher, and he was trying to write about, well, he was writing about faith, hope, and love. And as you can see, I will read out the quote, and he's talking about the appreciation that anyone has of the world, but he elides the appreciation that anybody might have of the world with the appreciation that a scientist might have of the world. So he says, when we find something we see good, glorious, wonderful, a tree, the structure of a diatom seen under the microscope, above all, of course, a human face of friends, one's partner for the whole of life, but also one's own existence in the world. When we see something good, I say, when we love something lovable, we might become aware of our actually taking up and continuing that universal approval of the creation by which all that has been created is loved by God and is therefore good. Now, Pieper was writing from his own perspective, not a scientist, but what he has to say, I think, speaks powerfully to me and what I understand about science and what some of us, what we explored when we were reflecting on what some of us thought about beauty. We said, it gives us joy. Beauty makes us joyful. It takes us out of ourselves. It makes us forget the kind of present moment and engage with the world in the way it is. And that is something that Pieper sees in this, in a theological frame of mind, in his talking about not only how we appreciate other people or the beauty of the world in various ways, but also the way in which we understand the world from a scientific perspective, a tree, the structure of a diatom seen under the microscope, and so on. So he is not making a distinction between the beauties that we see around us in everyday life or that we experience in our own lives and the beauty a scientist might find. And I don't think we should, because while of course we find different things beautiful, and we started by emphasising that, of course we find different things beautiful in different ways, whether it's another person, a picture, a bunch of flowers, whatever, a landscape, we find different things beautiful. But the point is we find them beautiful. The point is they take us outside of ourselves, they take us away from ourselves and make us forget about our own existence. And that actually is a wonderful thing, because it enables us to engage with them for what they are and relate to them as they really are in themselves and understand them better. We understand other people better when we relate to them and aren't thinking about ourselves. So that's one particular thing I want to say. And the other thing is to say that I'm not trying to say something particularly particularly focused, as I've tried to emphasise, on what is classically seen as being the beautiful in science, equations or symmetry. Of course, equations and symmetry are versions of beauty. They're aspects of beauty. But here's a very nice quote from somebody called Philip Ball, a popular philosopher, and he says, if we want beauty in science to make contact with aesthetics in art, I believe that we should seek it precisely in the human aspect, in ingenious experimental design, elegance of theoretical logic, gentle clarity of exposition, imaginative leaps of reasoning. These things are not vital for a theory that works, an experiment that succeeds, an explanation that enchants and enlightens, but they are rather lovely. Beauty, unlike truth or nature, is something we make ourselves. And I think this is true. We do make the beauty ourselves. We see it for ourselves, or we learn to see it. If we become a scientist, we learn to see beauty in new ways because of the way we learn to study the world. But actually, despite the fact we make it for ourselves, actively, quite actively, it turns out to be a route to what is truthful. It's because scientists are engaged passionately in what they, as a human being, because of their background and the way they were taught and goodness knows what else, find beautiful in their studies. It's because they are engaged in that they manage to make the discoveries that they do. If you're bored by something, you're not going to discover anything about it. You're just going to let it be itself, you're going to ignore it. It's because you are engaged with it, because you think it is gorgeous. That's why, in broad terms, that you want to study, that you are going to find things out about it. So I think Ball is right. He wants to shoot down the idea that symmetry and mathematics are wonderfully beautiful and that the beauty is truth. Indeed, as you can see, perhaps the title of his essay was Beauty is Truth, There's a False Equation. Well, that's true. Beauty is not truth, but our appreciation of beauty is a good way for us to access truth. And that is quite surprising because, as we emphasised before, right at the beginning, the subjective and the objective are seen in tension. Beauty is something that we experience subjectively, but the objective is what we seem to be wanting to get to in science. And if we're finding that what is subjectively pleasing to us is also a good route to beauty, that seems to be a surprising thing, maybe. So what I want to do is just to finish by reflecting on what this has to do with my theme of why you have to be human to work things out. And one of the things I try to emphasise is the way in which it's us, as human beings, with our backgrounds and our understanding, who see the beauty. It's us who appreciate the world for itself. So that is a characteristic that we have as people. But why should it be that our ability to appreciate beauty is a way to access what is true, as indeed I think it is, and as any scientist who will incessantly tell you about how beautiful their particular findings are would, I hope, agree. You know, it is true that they find what they study beautiful. And one of the, probably the reason they really do what they do is because of the beauty they find in it. They don't do it for utilitarian reasons. They do it because they are glad to study something and to be filled with joy, as we said, with what they study. So I suppose, in summary, the summary of how I would try and explain that, I mean, there are various ways to try and explain it. You could just say it's an accident. It's just the way things are. You could say it's just one of those things. I mean, human beings have all sorts of feelings about what they do. You can shrug. You can just, you know, not want to engage with the issue. But I think, I mean, in terms of thinking, well, it's just one of those things, maybe it is just one of those things. Maybe it's just a sort of epiphenomenon of science. You know, scientists find things beautiful. Scientists are monstrously selfish. Scientists have huge egos. Scientists behave very badly towards each other, etc. Scientists squabble over toys. But the point about the beauty thing is it's creative. It's because they find things beautiful that they keep on doing what they do. All the other things that scientists do that go with being a scientist, being clever, being badly behaved and so on, they're not creative. They're quite destructive, actually, socially. But the beauty that scientists see is something which is very energizing and something which is generative of understanding for them. It's because they find it's beautiful that they find out what is true. So I'm not sure that just shrugging is an approach we can take. So what I want to suggest to you is that a way to summarize how we might make sense of this is to say that it's a good way to find out what's truthful, to see the world as beautiful, because we weren't the first to find it beautiful, because in a sense, in a very important sense, the world has been considered beautiful from its foundation by the one who founded it, by the one who created it. So if we look at the first chapter of Genesis, there is this constant iteration of the idea that God thinks the world is good. And I think we should read into that affirmation that God finds the world beautiful and it fills him with joy. He is delighted, if you can use such terms of God, he is joyful, full of joy at the beauty of the world. He finds it good. And it seems to me that a way to make sense of the way in which what we find beautiful is a route for us finding out what is truthful is to understand ourselves as being in the image of God. God makes the world beautiful in itself to God's pleasure, and it turns out that for us, who Christians believe are made in the image of God, appreciating that beauty for ourselves gives us a kind of look over God's shoulder. It gives us a sense of understanding the world for itself in the way that God understands it, because we must believe, I guess, that God understands the world in a complete sense, and indeed it's through the understanding of the world that you could argue God gives the world being, gives sustains its existence. So the point is that by seeing the beauty of the world, we are expressing our imaging of God. We are expressing the sense in which we are in the image of God. And of course, this idea of the image of God is something that you can try and interpret in various ways. You can interpret in terms of intelligence, interpret in terms of morality. You could interpret it in terms of characteristics of the human personality being somehow Trinitarian. It seems to me that what underlies all those different ways of thinking about why humans are in the image of God is to think of humans as loving, and it's their capacity to love in a unselfish way, which I believe humans do have, a characteristic that God has given us. We love because God loved us first. It's because of that that we are able to image God. That is most fundamentally what it means for us to image God, that we can love. And it's the love that we have for the world that allows us to study it scientifically. Because what is it for us to be glad about something existing for itself, to appreciate its beauty, to be joyful about its existence, if not, in a sense, in an important sense, to love it? And it's by loving something, by respecting it, by allowing it to be independent of ourselves, that we are enabled to come to an understanding of it. One, I think, the truisms in a way of Christianity is that we humans are most themselves when they forget about themselves. We are most authentically ourselves when we're not worried about who we are. A mother is most herself when she is focused on her child. A scientist is most herself when she is focused on her studies. And in it's in that self-forgetting, loving attitude, I think, that we come to image God. And it's in that self-forgetting, loving attitude that we are enabled, through this love of the world that God has created, to come to an understanding of it in itself, in what we call science. And that's why I believe that you have to be human to be able to work things out. And there I'll finish.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Professor Gilbert. We have quite a few minutes for questions, and Professor Gilbert has said he's happy to take them. So if you have any questions or comments or points of discussion,
sure.
We can transition into a time for that now.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Anna. So I'm a scientist working in quantum foundations. So thank you for your talk. I really enjoyed it. So thinking about beauty in science, I think most of your points were linked to the resolution of a matter, so the understanding of the structure of DNA,
yeah,
the hydrogen atom. And I wondered if you had any thoughts on kind of the allure of mystery, so the kind of the not yet there, the kind
sure.
of not yet reaching the...
Sure, thank you, Ella. That's a very helpful question. One thing I'll say to your question is, immediate response is, that's a very perceptive remark, and I think it just underlies why I'm the kind of scientist I am, that I became a biochemist because I liked the idea that we could resolve things, that we could see molecules, you know. And it was the capacity to understand things in chemistry at school that led me into doing it. So that has coloured my approach. In terms of the mystery, things we can't resolve, things we don't know, things that we aren't, the not yet. Well, I suppose you can come back and if this doesn't answer your question, but I think I probably would go back to this issue of the idea of the sublime and the beautiful. So I've used beauty in quite a slipshod sort of way because it's easy and because I think that for many people, beauty is something they recognise. And even though it has different categories from a philosophical point of view, actually, if you're glad about something, you think it's beautiful. And most people would not make a fundamental distinction in their minds between a beautiful picture and a beautiful landscape, in some senses, because they're just glad about it anyway, and they'll stand and look at either. Okay, but I think if we just go back from that to sort of try and think in terms of two different categories, the sublime and the beautiful. The sublime, the awesome, what overpowers us, mountainscapes, oceans, and so on. Then I think that does draw us in. We're kind of fascinated. And I guess there are two approaches that you can have to that. You can be terrified, as Pascal was, okay? You can be terrified by infinite spaces and cold, infinite vacuum and so on, and dark. Or you can want to understand it for itself or try and find the beauty in it. And maybe it's just the psychological attitude of scientists who are studying such things, that they are drawn in, that, you know, that Justin Bell Burnell was not horrified by looking into the vast space, but wanted to see what patterns there were that she could understand, and she saw pulsars, you know. So it might well just be a psychological feature that some scientists will enjoy looking for mystery, and some will be happier staying with what they already know more or less to be beautiful, but they can do more and cleverer versions of the same thing over and over again. But I think it's still, in some sense, a search for the beautiful, which is still leading them towards the truth. So I think this idea of the sublime and the beautiful is quite a helpful way to think about the two different ways in which beauty and science come together. But one is about appreciating the exquisiteness of how things are made, are constructed, whether it's atoms or viruses or whatever. And the other side is trying to let the world sort of impinge on us and appreciate it, but not be horrified, but find the pattern that there is there. And it's the kind of the belief there is a pattern, actually, is part of the appreciation of the beauty too. It's not thinking, oh, this is some kind of vast some vast threatening darkness that wants to engulf me. It's thinking, well, actually, this is something I could understand, and maybe understanding it will gladden me. Does that help?
Yeah, well, from a personal point of view, what I love the most is everything we don't understand.
Sure.
But that's probably a personality thing.
No, sure. But also, I mean, so the understanding that we don't know everything means that there's always more to be found. There's always more beauties to be discovered.
And but even when in the face of it, for some things, I'm sure there will be a resolution, but they might never be found in my lifetime.
No, sure, sure.
But it's just the kind of, excitement of... Well, there's so much we don't...
And that's wonderful. And what's more is, unlike many scientists, you're perhaps... This sounds a really weird thing to say, maybe. It sounds... awful. So I always think something slightly tragic about getting a Nobel Prize. So so I, what I mean by that, or there's certainly something tragic about people who are obsessed about particular indicators of esteem. Okay, because to arrive somewhere means you've got there, and the things you don't, there are things you don't have to achieve. And relatively few people have won two Nobel Prizes. Some have, of course, as you know, but not many, and even fewer for both for two sciences or the same science. So I think that there is something wonderfully optimistic about constantly searching. It's like a pilgrimage, isn't it, really? And the word pilgrimage is not inappropriate, I think, and indeed many secular scientists would probably be happy to use the word. It's that search for meaning, and that belief that there's always more to be found is actually rather gladdening. And the idea that you finish with your work, I think it's why scientists can find it hard to retire. You know, the idea you finish your work and you're going to leave it behind can be difficult. Of course, the really virtuous thing is to be glad that somebody else with kind of firmer limbs is going to, and a quicker brain is going to sort of pick it up and carry on where you left off. But no, what you said is extremely helpful, and it's a very helpful reminder that it's that search, that yearning to understand more, but the knowledge that you won't understand everything is very important. And it's actually one of the more virtuous sides of science, because it's not obsessed with indicators of esteem and public recognition. It's more obsessed with just getting at the truth. I hope that's helpful. But I agree with you, basically, yes. But it's a very helpful corrective to have. Thank you.
I was struck by the comments you made that scientists are driven by beauty, as opposed to the word you used was utilitarian concerns. There's a line of thinking in European philosophy, people like Adorno, Horkheimer, and Heidegger, who say that all of modern science is basically based on a motivation to exploit the environment. It's this kind of like romanticist reactions, where once the world was full of beauty and was sublime, now we want to break it down into its component parts and exploit everything for profit, etc., etc. I'm just curious about your comment, because it seems to be quite discordant with what you said.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. It's a sense in which the science is trying to make the world less charmed, in a sense. It's trying to make it useful in a everyday sort of sense, and as you say, sort of evacuated of mystery, in fact. So I think that is a component of what some scientists do, but I think that it's I think it's not really what motivates them, is one thing to say. And I suppose I feel that quite a lot of what scientists do continues, I think, to be, even though it looks from the outside like it's this sort of exercise in breaking things down and laicizing things, making things everyday and very kind of utilitarian. I actually think that what really drives them is not the desire to do that, because I believe that, because they're people. I don't think people, I think generally speaking, people are generous hearted, and I think generous hearted people want to understand things for better reasons than just because they can control them or dominate them, I suppose. And one thing that may be relevant, I don't know, is that in science, sometimes people make distinctions between technicians and scientists. Okay? And of course, you might verbally associate technicians with, you might associate technicians with sort of the more everyday, the more pragmatic, the more just applying things, and you might associate scientists with people who are more blue skies and more exploratory. I don't think this is a very helpful distinction, apart from anything else. Some of the best scientists I know are what other people would call technicians, and some of the most kind of technical people I know are people who are more just interested in application, or just in cutting things down and, if you like, robbing the world of its sort of mystery, are people who call themselves scientists. So I think it takes all sorts, but I think that what drives science forward in terms of its advances is not this kind of this desire to rob the world of its charm, or to to just apply it in a way that is in an everyday sense useful. I think what drives it forward is the hunger to understand better what things really are like in themselves. And perspective that may be helpful there is just this, that the comment that a number of people may have made, that you know, just to iterate over and over again what you already know how to do is not the way in which you make discoveries. The way you make discoveries is you take leaps of imagination. You have to think outside the box. In terms of the playing games analogy, you know, you a hypothesis is a kind of game of make-believe. And I think that requires an attitude which is different from the one that's being criticised by those philosophers. I'm not saying it isn't part of modern science. I'm just saying that I think that the interesting parts of modern science, I don't believe can align with it, because I think that what makes science interesting and what gives science its purchase on reality is not that attitude, but yet the hunger for understanding of things themselves and appreciation of things for themselves. Is that helpful?
That's really helpful. It makes perfect sense. Although, would you say then that there's an irony that the more that scientists, because of beauty and because of their playfulness, the more they discover about the cosmos, the more that the technicians, so to speak, have to exploit?
Yes, there is an irony there. There's also an irony in the sense that the more senior you become as a scientist, I think the danger is the more of a technician. So and of course, the problem is I'm using technician in two different ways. I'm actually saying that some of the people that important scientists will say are technicians are some of the best scientists I know. They are the best people who have the most kind of imagination, the most kind of free thinking, the least kind of desire to dominate the world and make it fit their needs. And some of the senior scientists I know are most given to trying to make the world fit their plans for the future, as it were, or their plan for how it ought to turn out to be. So there's this sort of tension. But yes, it is. So the other side of that irony is that the older you get, the more given you are to losing, I think, wonder. I think that's a tragedy. Now, of course, many scientists keep wonder as something that they are able to enjoy throughout their lives, and they continue to be animated by their thrill at what they study and their joy, as we emphasise, the joy in what they study. But it's a shame when scientists become disenchanted themselves with how things are. So yes, it is ironic. It's ironic in the sense you identify, in the sense that the more we find out, the more there is to be exploited. But it's also ironic in the sense that the more an individual finds out, the more they're in danger of choosing to exploit rather than choosing to enjoy. If that helps. Yeah, and then I'll go to Jenny, sorry.
Thank you very much for being with us today. Yeah. My question has to do with the role of beauty in convincing people of the existence of God.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a lot of friends who are in the medical or biological sciences who place Cartesian rationale and reason, like we all do, in trying to disprove the existence of anything beyond humans. No matter what I say or no matter what other believers say, not convincing friends of existence. Do you think that beauty could convince such? Do you think beauty can convince human beings of an existence of God or a higher being?
Or values or something? I mean, yes, I would hope so. I think it requires. I think it requires some quite fundamental honesty for individuals to see that. But I think, which maybe sounds a terrible thing to say, sorry, but I think yes, I would hope that it might be. And the reason why, obviously, is you say to somebody, well, you appreciate that picture, you know, why is it not okay to destroy it? You know, you love that symphony, why is it not okay if it were completely lost and never heard again? What is it about it that you value? And I think that most people would have the honesty to acknowledge that there are things about what they find beautiful, what they really are convinced are profoundly beautiful, which are transcendent in some sense or another. Now, it might be they think the transcendence is tragic, in the sense that, it's transcendent, but it's all meaningless because everything's meaningless and we're all just going to die and the universe is going to explode and so on. But we'll continue exploding. But the point is that that's an attitude. But I think that actually what makes people glad about lives are the beauties that they enjoy, whether it's music, friends, artwork or whatever. And I think that they are things that they see as having transcendent value. And I think that's a way in, that's what I'm saying. Because I'm saying that it's a way in to helping people to understand that there are things, even though they might claim that all they value is really science, there are things they value in life which are not about science, and which they actually value, I would suggest, in many cases, more than their science. And indeed, and this would always be a difficult thing to raise, when it comes to human relationships, this is even more clear. Because basically, somebody can tell you somebody can say, oh, I only believe things that are proved scientifically, you know, and I'm an empiricist, and I think scientifically, and you need to prove to me the existence of God in a scientific sort of way. Well, that's all very well, but their wife didn't prove her love to him in a scientific way, and their children don't prove their love, and he doesn't prove his love in a scientific way. He loves them, and he loves his wife, or she loves her husband, or whatever. And that is a fundamental thing they do, and it is actually the core thing in their life. Almost certainly, it's far more important. They love their parents, or whatever. It's far more important than science in the end. If push came to shove, they'd give up the science and stick with the family, you know? And that shows that all people, I think, have the capacity for, and almost everyone does, enjoy values in their lives which are clearly transcendent and which are not to do with scientific understanding. And it's not even an argument, but I do think it's a very simple thing to put side by side. Somebody can say, I'm a scientist, I only believe empirical facts, and you say to them, well, I'm sorry, you don't actually, because you believe in the love of your family. You know you love them and you believe in your love for them. And you probably also believe in various higher moral values as well. There are things it's always wrong to do. It's always wrong to torture children. It's always wrong to kill people unnecessarily and so on. So it's people do have higher moral values. And I think that that is a way into helping them understand that there are things that they understand to be true without them being proved, without them being scientifically open to evidence. There are things they take to be self-evidently correct, and those are the best examples. And of course, the link then to make is just to say, well, it's a kind of category error to think of God as something that has to be proved in a scientific way. God is not something that has to prove in a scientific way. God is something, But the point is, God is one to relate to. It's a relationship. It's all about relationship, which is the point of Jesus, really. That it was all about relationship, and indeed is the point about what I said about humans being most themselves when they forget about themselves, mothers being most themselves when they focus on their children, scientists being most themselves when all they're worried about is their experiments. That's all about relationship, becoming pure relationship, and God is pure relationship. That is what we mean, I guess, by saying God is love. And and that is one of the most profound things that a human being can come to understand. But the funny thing is, it's something that almost everyone understands from their own personal experiences because of the personal relationships they have in their lives. So I think beauty is a good way in because you relate to beauty in that sense, but I would say that actually because it's close to most people's experience and also more fundamental to what it is to be a human being, the experience of love of other people is an even better way in. And of course it makes the way in which love of the world, which is what I think we gauge in when we do science, all the more obviously something that only people can do, and something which something whose power to deliver real understanding demands an explanation. I hope that's helpful. Sorry, yes, Jane.
I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about what beauty is. What is the distinction of beauty? And I find myself lying awake at night pondering this question, because often, and maybe this is because I spend too much time in the Neoplatonic early Christian world, but often when I hear scientists such as yourself speak about beauty, there seems to be a sense in which beauty is related to order, beauty
sure.
is related to enjoyment, beauty is related to form,
sure.
beauty is related to love. But none of those things are what beauty is, none of those things are what is distinctive about beauty. And I really want to know, what is beauty? I know what Plato would say beauty is, but since you've sort of unhinged beauty from truth and goodness, it seems like there you would have a different definition. So maybe this is an oversimple question, but I'd love to hear you maybe work with us towards
okay.
a definition of what is the distinctive of beauty.
So one thing to say, I think, is that in response to your point about truth, beauty, and goodness, I don't think I'd say I'd unhinge them. I think I'd say that, in a way, what I've tried to say is that beauty is where we find truth and goodness, or that beauty is the perception of truth and goodness in something that we see or hear or whatever. What I mean by that is that we can find it, we find it meaningful, we find it full of sense, and I think that that is to see the goodness and the truth of something. And beauty is actually a way of responding. It's our response to that, probably very, mostly very often, subconscious experience. I think that beauty is what, you could say that beauty is what makes things stand out, in some sense. So what I mean is that there's something about, so if you take the example of artifacts of beauty, they are things that are deliberately made, or deliberately organized or placed where they are. And so there's something about the beauty which is us being enabled to, our appreciation of beauty is about us being enabled to see the world kind of more profoundly as it really is, by helping us to see it in a more particular way and to appreciate it for itself. I mean, most fundamentally, I would say that beauty is about appreciating things for themselves and being glad that they exist. It's that quote from Pieper highlighted. But I think that, and as you say, many people identify beauty with order, and of course we've referred to that, think about symmetry and so on. And that is true. But there is also a lot of beauty in the out of place, and the slightly broken, and the slightly asymmetric, you know, in the beauty spot, you know. There's beauty, the Japanese find, I believe, crack in a teacup, exquisitely beautiful, you know. There's a great example actually I have, which I think is a lovely example. So it's an example given, I don't know, some of you may have heard the Radio 4 essay A Point of View. Sometimes it's on 10 to 9 on a Sunday morning. And last year, January of last year, there was a you'll be able to listen to it, still on iPlayer. I think it's one of these things they don't take down, by A.L. Kennedy, who's a Scottish novelist and short story writer. And it was called, I think, The Power of Art, or something like that. Anyway, it was in January last year. It was an absolutely extraordinary essay, and it was about the power of beauty, and also partly why some people want to destroy beauty just because they can. And the example she began with is that she came into her mother's flat one day, and on the tray, as she came in through the front door, there was a bowl of rose petals. And her mother had, well, it turned out that there was, sitting next to the bowl of rose petals was a single rose petal sitting there. And A.L. Kennedy picked it up and tidied it into the bowl. She thought to herself, that shouldn't be there, it should be in the bowl. So she picked it up in the bowl. And as she did it, her mother said, don't do that, leave it. And A.L. Kennedy's point is that her mother, A.L. Kennedy's point, she says, is that her mother had, you know, at a time when she needed something beautiful in her life, when things were difficult at work, when she needed something to gladden her, she had deliberately, all she'd done was take a rose petal from a bowl, it was perfectly good in its bowl, but she'd taken it and put it by the side, so it's on its own, it's unique. And that it was a thing of beauty to her. And A.L. Kennedy then feels guilty, of course, because she has broken this thing, she's destroyed this thing of beauty. Her mother did it deliberately. No matter what she does now, she can't undo the fact that she moved it, right? And so it's that act, that deliberate act of putting something beautiful on the side, was something that created. Now, that rose petal, okay, it's beautiful in a sense, but most people would think nothing of it. It's just a rose petal. It can drop to the ground and be forgotten about. But it's because her mother had deliberately done something with it that I think there is something profoundly important about it. It's because it's deliberate and it's appreciated for itself. And I think that that maybe is at the core of what beauty is, which then brings it back to love again. In a book which has some relationship to what I have said, Rowan Williams, called The Edge of Words, published I think last year, Rowan Williams speaks similarly of a single bowl in a room. He's talking about beauty, and he says, if you just play, all you've got to do is place a single bowl in a room, and that is a beautiful thing. So it's a slightly more mannered example of A.L. Kennedy's mother's rose petal, but it's an example of the same thing. It's the unique thing, the thing that's been done deliberately, that, I think, for me is what is at the core of what beauty is. It's noticing things for themselves, noticing the unique, And when we make something beautiful, it's the thing that's been done deliberately. And when it comes back to the sublime, the big things, again, it's sort of trying to... I think it's still the same thinking applies there, because it's, if you're overwhelmed by the sublime, what it is, it's sort of taking in the sort of unity of what you're appreciating, rather than thinking, oh, there's a mountain peak, and there's a mountain peak, and there's a mountain peak, and there's a mountain peak. You're overwhelmed by the Himalayas, you know, or seeing a sea, thinking, oh, there's a little wave, another little wave. You're overwhelmed by the vastness of the sea. And I think that, or looking into space, you see individual stars, but you're overwhelmed by the vastness of the Milky Way and the hundreds of millions of stars, and then you think about the vastness of the whole universe. And it's being able to, it's getting in your mind an appreciation of how it might be to see things in the round, is the appreciation of the beauty at that level. And of course, in a way, since presumably God is not horrified by eternal silent spaces, God presumably also finds them beautiful, and God sees all of this all the time, completely, as in a sense, it's a part of trying to share that perspective that God has, not only the exquisiteness of the individual thing, but also the grandeur of the whole, but seeing both at the same time. And individual scientists do different things at different times. Individual human beings see the exquisiteness and the grandeur at different times. We don't really see both at the same time, generally speaking. It depends where we're focusing. But I suppose we believe that for God, the grandeur and the exquisite beauty of the particular are side by side all the time, are interwoven all the time. But as I say, that particular example, a rose petal on a tray by a bowl of rose petals, is a great example, I think, of what would characterise the beauty, the thing which is just deliberate. It's just been done because it can be, and because it can be appreciated for itself. I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, it is really helpful. But I wonder, what if someone shredded the rose petal,
or yeah.
If I thought it were beautiful to pull a painting off the wall and shred it and sort of like take a little piece of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that absolutely. Beauty?
No. Well, so I hope this isn't too kind of flip or too quick, but I suppose I just say, but given how long some of my answers are, that you'd probably be glad it's quick. But in the end, you know, everything can be perverted, right? And we can get everything wrong. We can always sin, okay? And I think, and obviously you could say to me, well, I think it's beautiful to tear this picture up. It's part of me expressing who I am. Well, that would be a matter for discussion, wouldn't it? You know, and maybe for the law courts. But the point is, the point is that everything can be perverted. And obviously, you know, what people think is perverted and wrong changes, has changed, will continue to change. People will change in their thinking about assisted dying, whether there are things that people's minds change over, they are matters for debate. But I think we do believe there are things which are wrong and things that are right. And I think good things can always be spoilt. And if they are spoilt, then that is a horror.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to acknowledge that we can bang on about beauty all we like, but beauties can be ruined. And indeed, actually, in this A.L. Kennedy essay, she talks about the Khmer Rouge, and she talks about people being killed just because they were too beautiful.
Mm.
So this idea that the beauty can be destroyed, and in fact the subtitle for her thing was Why Tyrants Are Afraid of Art and Beauty.
Mm.
Because the whole point is that beauty is a kind of affront to those who want to destroy the good, the beautiful, and the true. Partly because it's there, because they can destroy it, because if somebody's organised something, then you can easily disorganise it. So things can always be got wrong and ruined. And it's a tragedy.
Mm.
But our job is to try and preserve what is good, try and agree on what is good, what is beautiful, and to preserve it. But obviously, things can always go wrong. And it's also our job to try and work out what it would be for things to go wrong and to avoid that happening as far as we can.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any last quick questions? Well, then on that note, let's thank Professor Yoren again.